Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. The new book, Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto, wasn't what I expected it to be. I thought I'd be reading mostly about all the amazing discoveries made during the historic flyby of Pluto in July of 2015 that was shared by millions around the world via social media and television. But the authors, Alan Stern, the principal investigator or scientific leader of the mission, and his friend, astrobiologist and science communicator David Grinspoon, take us on an amazing journey about how very difficult it was to reach Pluto. From a small group of scientists, including Stern, came the idea to propose a mission to Pluto in the afterglow of Voyager 2's flyby of Neptune in 1989. That left one robotically unexplored planet in the solar system, the ninth planet, Pluto. Over the decades, Stern and a cadre of scientists and engineers proposed missions, had them tentatively approved by NASA administrators, only to see them get canceled or postponed for an array of reasons. But the group, and Stern in particular, never gave up their dream of exploring Pluto, and in the end, against nearly all odds, it happened in stunningly successful fashion. We'll talk to Alan Stern in the second half of the show, but first, we talk with the man that Stern chose to help tell the story of New Horizons, David Grinspoon. David's father, Lester, was a close friend of Carl Sagan's, and he's carried on Sagan's legacy as a scientist who puts a lot of energy into communicating to the public the hows and whys of space exploration. The inaugural chair of astrobiology for the Library of Congress, David's most recent book is Earth in Human Hands, published in 2016. He's appeared in print in Scientific American as well as the New York and Los Angeles Times. And he's a returning guest on Blue Dot. David Grinspoon, welcome once again to the show.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be talking with you.
Let's go back before your story and Alan's story, because at the beginning in 1930, is the discovery of Pluto. And just, can you give us a really capsule view of what that was all about, and tell us about the importance of Clyde Tombaugh to the story?
Yeah, I love the story of Clyde Tombaugh and how it fits into this story, because, I mean, one of the interesting things about Pluto is that, you know, it's not that long ago. Clyde Tombaugh discovered Pluto in 1930, so there are people alive now who were alive when Pluto was discovered. And so it's, you know, there's a sort of generational aspect to the whole thing. And Clyde Tombaugh was this, you know, sort of classic American hard luck and success story. He was a farm boy in Kansas during the Depression, you know, hard luck times on the farm, a lot of hard work, very poor. And he was fascinated with astronomy, and he went, you know, local library, learned everything he could. His dad got him a little telescope out of the Sears Roebuck catalog, and then he used it, but then it wasn't good enough. So he learned to build his own telescopes and grind his own lenses. And, you know, when there was a little free time, because it wasn't harvest time or whatever on the farm, he would be out there at night by himself, looking at the planets with his telescope and making sketches of Mars and other planets. And in the vain hope that somebody out there would, you know, like throwing a message in a bottle, he would mail his sketches off to different observatories. He mailed some of them to the Lowell Observatory. And Clyde never thought he'd be able to be an astronomer, because he couldn't imagine he'd ever have the money to go to college and not have to just stay and help out on the farm. But he mailed these sketches of Mars off to Lowell Observatory. And one day he got a letter back saying, you know, Mr. Tombaugh, we really like we're impressed with your telescopic sketches of Mars. Would you like a job at the Lowell Observatory? And, you know, of course he said, sure. But Clyde had basically never left the farm and never been out of Kansas. And so, you know, he got on the train with some sandwiches his mom packed him and, like, went off and chugged off on the train up to Flagstaff, Arizona, to the Lowell Observatory. As, you know, he was he was a very young man, and he had no experience in the world, but he was a very good observer. And then he spent a year of cold nights looking for this new planet. You know, that they hired him to continue this search for what they called Planet X. And people said, oh, you're a crazy kid. It'll, you know, you'll never find it. You're wasting your time. And there was a lot of doubt. And it was painstaking work, photographing the sky night after night, seeing if he could find something moving in the right way. And after about a year of this, you know, blinking between the before and after pictures of the night and the next night to see what moved between the nights, after about a year of this, he found what he was looking for, found this little object moving from night to night in just the right way. And it was early 1930, January 1930, he discovered the planet Pluto. And, you know, in addition to all the other things that happened that allowed Clyde to live out his life dream of becoming, he did in fact become a professional astronomer, you know, based on that, and, you know, made it off of the farm and into the history books. And and Clyde's widow was at the launch of New Horizons to Pluto, and his kids were at the encounter, when we made it to Pluto. So there's this cool kind of sense of the poignant generational passing of the torch too, where, it's pretty close to living memory that Clyde Tombaugh was there discovering Pluto, and now the next generation and the generation of after that, and we've been to Pluto.
And his ashes are on the spacecraft.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's another very poignant part of the story for us is that Alan arranged to have a small bit of Clyde Tombaugh in the form of his ashes actually make it out to Pluto, the planet he discovered in 1930. A little bit of Clyde is on the spacecraft and will not only made it past Pluto, but will escape the sun's gravity and wander the galaxy forever. Only the fifth human-made object to do so.
When's the launch? Remind us, when was the launch of New Horizons?
The launch was January 2006. That was quite something. You know, I was there, and, there were a lot of people gathered there. It felt like kind of the Woodstock of planetary science, and that, you know, it was such a gathering of people with so many hopes and dreams riding on it. Because there's a sense with New Horizons, there's a sense that it was, in a way, kind of the last first. If that makes sense, like, you know, there had been the Voyagers where we had done the first flybys of all these outer planets. And before that, there were the Mariners and the Pioneers were the first flybys of Venus and Mars. But in our generation after Voyager, there hadn't really been a first flyby of a new planet. And, I don't know when there will be again. And so this felt like something really special to be at that launch. It was just thrilling.
Well, yeah, since 1989, when Voyager 2 flew by Neptune, that was the last great first encounter until 2015 in July when New Horizons flies by Pluto. But back up a bit to 2006, I believe it was, and right when all of this very exciting stuff is happening, you have the great demotion, if you will, by the IAU. Could you just briefly comment on, you know, how you guys felt about that?
Yeah, you know, honestly, it's kind of dumb. The so-called demotion of Pluto, it just didn't really make a lot of sense the way they did it. I mean, the thing is, okay, we were discovering a lot of new planets in the outer solar system, and we were discovering all these planets around other stars, the exoplanets. So it did make sense to reconsider how we define the word planet. And there was a proposal that was looked at that really did make a lot of sense, to just consider a planet to be anything that is orbiting a star and is big enough to be round by itself gravity, but not so big that it itself becomes a star. That makes a lot of sense. And they floated that proposal, and then, you know, it got bogged down in a lot of amendments and reproposals, and it didn't get decided till the very end of the meeting when most people had left. And they didn't want to end the meeting without agreeing on a definition of the word planet. So they all sort of in desperation voted for the last proposal that came up. And it just wasn't very well thought out because they defined planet in a way that it doesn't reflect the intrinsic properties of an object. It's defined with respect to what else is orbiting around it. So supposedly if an object hasn't cleared its zone, it's not a planet. And if it has cleared its zone, it is a planet. And what does that even mean? You know, something about the other objects that are orbiting around you makes you a planet, not what your own properties are. And it's very silly because, for instance, it means that the Earth was not a planet for its first 500 million years when it was surrounded by a swarm of material. And if you took Earth today and moved it out into the asteroid belt, it, according to this definition, it wouldn't be a planet. And furthermore, they defined a planet as just something orbiting the sun. So all these exoplanets orbiting other stars are not planets, according to this definition. There's a lot of problems with it. And I think it will ultimately either be ignored or revised because, you know, planetary scientists, a lot of us now just sort of ignore it. And we talk about Pluto as a planet and we talk about, you know, even the largest asteroids that are round by their own self-gravity. We call them dwarf planets, too. And one other comment, that was the other silly thing they said. They said small planets like Pluto are dwarf planets. That's actually fine. That makes a lot of sense. But then they added this sort of vindictive addendum. They said a dwarf planet is not a planet. And that's just kind of silly linguistically. You know, for instance, the sun is considered a dwarf star because it's a relatively small star. But we don't add a dwarf star is not a star, you know, so... Anyways, I don't want to go on and on about this.
Yeah,
but,
no.
But we just think it's silly, the redefinition, and ultimately it won't really stand up historically.
I agree. And, you know, the bottom line to me is when those images came back in July of 2015 showing the stunning planet Pluto, you look at those images and what you see there, that planetary system, and it passes what I think Alan or somebody called the Star Trek test.
Yeah, exactly. The Star Trek test is great. Yeah, it comes on screen and, you know, what is it, Spock? Well, it's some kind of a planet. You know, it's like it looks like a planet. It's big, yeah. It's round, it's varied. It has mountains and geography and an atmosphere and moons. It's very silly to really to call it anything else.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Thanks for listening and stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with David Grinspoon, co-author with Alan Stern of Chasing New Horizons, inside the epic story of the first mission to Pluto. And we're back. Let's continue our conversation with David Grinspoon, co-author of Chasing New Horizons, inside the epic story of the first mission to Pluto. A big part of your book, and when I first started reading it, I was had a little trepidation. It's like, am I going to really find this interesting? Is about all of the convoluted history of trying to get this mission planned and approved through many iterations over many years, decades really, as these people known as the Pluto Underground, Alan and a lot of his colleagues, are trying to get a mission accepted to go out to Pluto and having a very difficult time with it. I actually, you know, as I read the book, I started to find myself thinking, this is just impossible. How could this have possibly happened with all of these factors going against it? So without, you know, going into exhaustive detail, could you just let our listeners know how difficult this journey was just to get a mission to go to Pluto?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the parts of the story that I really wanted to tell well, because, you know, there's a lot of books that talk about space exploration and kind of here's what happened, here's how the mission worked, and here's what we learned, and you know, and those are good books too, but we really wanted to kind of tell the backstory that answers the question, how does something like this actually happen when it starts off as just an idea, and how does it become a real mission, and what are all the different things that can befall a team trying to do this? And then the New Horizons story is amazing because sort of everything that can happen did happen as far as setbacks, and they just didn't give up. And but it was challenging to tell because a lot of that involves like the politics and, you know, committee decisions and proposals going to NASA. And it's like, you don't want to tell that stuff and make people fall asleep, you know. But in fact, it was very dramatic for the people involved because they were putting their lives into this, these rushes to put together a perfect mission proposal that couldn't be refused. And then NASA says, well, yeah, it is perfect, but we don't have the money anymore, so sorry. Or, you know, there were just all kinds of things that happened. And what we wanted to describe was really the emotions, too, of the team members and, you know, the ups and downs. And that way, I think we were able to hopefully to make it interesting because it's not just the story of the politics, but it's the experience of the people who threw themselves into every opportunity to make a mission to happen. And, you know, nights, weekends, like just all out effort, only to be told, well, you did a good job, but we changed our mind and there's not going to be a mission. Try again next year. And this went on for years. And then, you know, two successive presidential administrations canceled it. And that's the other thing you realize is that when you're pushing for something this long, the powers that be change. So even if you get one presidential administration to finally like it and want to approve it, then, you know, somebody else is elected in 4 years and you sometimes have to start from scratch. So the changing, you know, the changing power structure at NASA and in the federal government was a challenge for this team that, you know, worked on this thing for, you know, well, really for 26 years from the time that Alan first started pushing to this till they actually made it to Pluto in July 2015. So, you know, it's against the background of that shifting government set of priorities and set of players that they just had to keep pushing and make this happen.
Well, and there were so many times that I think I was thinking to myself, if I was involved in this, that it would have been so hard just to keep going. And yet they do, and they persevere. And in the end, Pluto gets explored.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because they say one of the definitions of insanity is, you know, getting the same result every time, but not changing your behavior. So, I mean, by one definition, you could say these guys were a little bit nuts to keep going. And yet, history proved them right. They were able to. But, you know, it wasn't just politics. There were some other things that went wrong. They needed a certain amount of plutonium to power this thing when it got to Pluto. You know, you can't use solar power when you're that far from the sun. There just isn't enough sunlight. So you use plutonium. And that itself is a bit of a nightmare because, you know, as you can imagine, the regulatory you know, just the hurdles you have to do, the environmental impact statements and everything are really intense, as they should be, because that's serious stuff. But, you know, there was a huge effort just to get the approvals and everything. But then something went wrong in the lab that makes the plutonium.
Los Alamos.
At Los Alamos, yeah. They got shut down because of a security breach. It had nothing to do with New Horizons, but there was a ticking clock. They needed to launch by 2006 or not launch at all because of, you know, the way things are moving in the heavens and the way Jupiter is moving in its orbit, and you have to get to Jupiter by a certain date so he can be slingshot out to Pluto. So they had to launch by this window in 2006, and they were rushing to produce enough plutonium, and then the lab got shut down indefinitely, and it looked for a while like they were just not going to be able to launch because they wouldn't have the power supply. And then it managed to get scraped together. But that was one of so many factors that, like, could have sunk it. You know, over and over again, there were things that looked like they could have sunk it, but somehow they kept going. It really, in a way, when you add up all the things that seemed like they were going to go wrong and then didn't, it seems sort of miraculous that it all worked.
It does. And that was the joy of reading the story was, you know, I knew that I was there for the flyby, you know, as far as on the internet and social media and following you guys. I knew what happened. I knew it was a success. And as I was reading the book, I kept thinking to myself, there's no way this is going to happen.
That's what's funny, too, is that, you know, it's a peculiar kind of story to tell because you want to highlight the drama. And you want people to think at various times, are they going to succeed? Is this going to work? And yet, of course, people know how the story came out. There's a freaking picture of Pluto on the cover of the book, and it wouldn't be there if it hadn't worked. And yet, I think we succeeded in highlighting the drama enough so that when you read it, you get nervous. In fact, I still get nervous when I read it. And honestly, there are parts of the book that still bring tears to my eyes, and which made it hard every time I had to edit it. And then I read the audiobook out loud in the studio, and literally there are parts that sort of choke me up still, that because I just can't believe that it unfolded the way that it did.
Well, when you realize, you know, the amount of years and hours and of so many people dedicated to making this happen, and all of the obstacles that are overcome, and right at the end, you know, just a few days, what was it, July 4th, you lose contact with the spacecraft. And I remember when that happened, and I remember thinking to myself, oh no, you know, just before they get to Pluto, they've lost contact with the spacecraft. Could you tell us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was crazy. It was over the July 4th weekend before the July 14th flyby. So 10 days before closest approach, all of a sudden, they completely lose contact with the spacecraft. The worst possible time. This hadn't happened. They've been traveling for 9 years to Pluto, and they've never lost contact in this way. And then all of a sudden, we're almost at Pluto, and there's no spacecraft. There's no signal. And you know, at that moment, you think the worst. That people were wondering, you know, did it hit something somehow? Did it blow up? Did something break so badly that we'll just never be able to get in contact with it again? It's a horrible feeling. And, you know, I mean, in space flight, if you study the history of space flight, these things happen. There are spacecraft that have blown up right before they got to their target, you know, so something could have happened. And so in that interval before they heard from the spacecraft, they didn't know if they were going to ever hear again. And then they did fortunately recover contact with the spacecraft. But then they were in a horrible situation because they had a spacecraft that was missing, you know, in the reboot. A computer rebooted and it lost a lot of the crucial files. So it was missing some of the software that was needed to execute the encounter with Pluto. And here they are racing at 1,000,000 miles per day towards Pluto, and they can't stop. It's going to race past Pluto in a week, one way or another, working or not working. And they've got a very short time to fix everything and reload the crucial command sequences that it needs to execute the flyby. And it's much more dramatic when you realize that at that time, the spacecraft is so far away from Earth that even at the speed of light, it takes 4.5 hours for a signal to go from Earth to the spacecraft. So that's a 9-hour round trip time just to say, hey, spacecraft, is everything okay? What's your situation? And then you wait 9 hours and the spacecraft goes, well, I'm alive, but my computer's messed up. And then, you know, then you've got these 9-hour blocks of time to send up something and see if it worked and then wait to hear back. And then you calculate between now and when things have to start happening, they're not that many 9-hour blocks of time. So they had to be really crafty and work fast, but work carefully. And, you know, it was up all night and days and people sleeping on the floor and on desks and on cots and, you know, work going into this emergency mode to figure out how to get the spacecraft back on track and then send the commands up. And, you know, basically they got it working again with only hours to spare after a 9-hour trip. And it was an amazing job, an amazing credit to there's this woman, Alice Bowman, who is she's mom. She's the, yeah, that's her acronym. She's the mission operations manager, or MOM, and Alice runs the team that keeps contact with the spacecraft. And it was really her team and her leadership, to a large extent, that managed to do this work flawlessly in a very pressured and time-limited manner to get the spacecraft working again. And it did work, and they got it on track, and the flyby worked perfectly. But, you know, Alice and her team are really heroes of this story, to respond to the crisis in the way they did, and they managed to fix it just in the nick of time.
And then, of course, I think the wonderful thing is that it all works, and you get these amazing images back. Could you tell us, what was it like to be there, as, you know, because we all got to see these images, but it's different when you're there with the team. What was it like when those first really stunning images, and you know that it's working, that the mission is going to be a success? What was it like to be there?
It was very, very exciting, obviously, and very emotional, and it was just thrilling when those images came in, for so many reasons. For one thing, there's the relief. Oh my God, it worked. And not did it just work, it worked well. Look at the quality of the images. And then when you start seeing what's in the images, you also realize, wow, Pluto is stunning and is not like anybody could have predicted, and is beautiful and complex and strange. And there's a lot going on there that we don't understand. So, you know, in the back of my mind, and I know some of the other people who were involved, was this question, okay, well, what if it all does work against all odds? But then what if Pluto is, you know, kind of boring? What if it's just kind of a cratered ice ball? It would still be kind of cool to, you know, to have seen it. But then I would have gone all that way and said, well, yeah, it's all right, you know. But it was the opposite. I mean, Pluto exceeded anyone's expectation. You know, it's just, it's alive, you know. I mean, there's flowing seas of nitrogen ice that are churning and, you know, moving around on the surface, and there are giant mountains of water ice capped with, you know, methane snowfall. And, you know, there's, the surface is just alive with variations of terrain and activity. Nobody expected that much activity on a small world so far from the sun. So, you know, Pluto did not disappoint. It shone with its stunning diversity, and it's just, you know, it's such an interesting place. On top of everything else, Pluto turned out to be amazing.
So before we let you go, as a scientist, as a planetary scientist, give us just a few of the big takeaways. What have we learned about Pluto after the flyby, now that we've had some time to digest those images and the data? And by the way, in the book, there are some beautiful, stunning pictures of some of the things you just talked about. So that's also a neat thing in the book, is you get to see those images. But what are the big scientific takeaways thus far to you?
To me, the biggest is just, well, you know, every time we explore a new realm of the solar system, this has happened a few times, we get surprised by, you know, things that exceed our expectations and defy our predictions in sort of a specific way, which is that we always think that worlds that aren't like the Earth are going to be kind of dead and not interesting. That happened when we got to the moons of Jupiter, you know, with Voyager, and then with Galileo. We thought, well, they'll just be dead because there's not much sunlight and they're small, so there's not going to be much internal energy. But we didn't figure on the fact that they would have all this tidal heating from Jupiter. So those bodies were much more interesting and active than we thought they would be. But then with Pluto, we kind of expected, well, it's not going to be that interesting or active because there's no energy source and it's cold and that far from the sun. You know, we'll go see, but there's no reason to expect it's going to be geologically active. Of course, we get to Pluto now and there's like huge areas that are incredibly active. There are no impact craters, which tells us it's recent. There's something repaving that surface and wiping out the craters. And so, you know, once again, we find a kind of world that is much more active and vibrant than we thought. And in this case, it's because we didn't predict the qualities of the materials making up the surface of Pluto, especially this nitrogen ice even at very cold temperatures, with the small amount of heat that's just coming out of Pluto from the radioactive decay of the rocks inside, that's enough to make this ice start churning around. So you have these flowing glaciers of nitrogen on the surface of Pluto. We didn't expect that. So, you know, the big takeaway is that more kinds of worlds in the solar system are active and interesting than we thought. And in particular, that small worlds far from the sun can still be very vibrant and active. And you know, we even think now that there may be a liquid water ocean inside of Pluto. We have some sort of circumstantial evidence. We're still puzzling over the data to figure that one out. And of course, if that's true, then who knows, there could even be a biosphere inside of Pluto. So think about that.
Well, Plutonians.
Yeah, exactly. We can't rule it out at this point. You know, we keep discovering places in the solar system where there are oceans, and where there are oceans, there may be life. And Pluto now has to be counted amongst one of the worlds that seems to likely probably have an ocean inside.
David, thank you so much for your time today. It was really fun to talk to you, and just what a fascinating story.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot. I've enjoyed talking with you as well.
Thanks to David Grinspoon. When we come back, we'll talk with his friend and co-author Alan Stern, the lead scientist or principal investigator for New Horizons. I'm Dave Shlom, and you're listening to Blue Dot. Welcome back to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Alan Stern's dream for decades was to lead a scientific mission to explore Pluto, the last unexplored planet of the solar system after Voyager 2 flew by Neptune in 1989. While Pluto was technically demoted to dwarf planet status by the International Astronomical Union in 2006, Stern and a majority of planetary scientists don't accept that Pluto is not a planet, and for what it's worth, neither do I. When you see the stunning images of Pluto captured by New Horizons in 2015, it passes what Stern calls the Star Trek test. It looks like a planet on the view screen. Stern and his co-author David Grinspoon tell the story of the mission to Pluto in the new book, Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. Let's hear our conversation with the leader of the team that made history nearly 3 years ago. Alan Stern, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Thank you, David. It's great to be back.
One of the things that I found fascinating reading the book was the structure of it is kind of similar to the whole story of New Horizons. There's quite a long buildup of everything that had to happen, and most of the time didn't look like it was going to happen, leading up to the flyby. And then you get to the flyby, it happens so quickly. It's just a couple of days, and then that's over. But the epic story of how difficult it was to get this mission planned and approved, and the stops and starts, was something that I kept shaking my head thinking, I can't imagine myself being able to persevere through this. And I really admired the tenacity that you and your cohorts showed in sticking with this. Could you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, well, thanks for saying it. It did take a lot of determination, no question. And it was very involved. The book moves kind of quickly, but the story, you know, stretched out over 12 years between when we kind of had an idea we ought to try and pull this off, you know, till we finally got funded to do it. And it had all kinds of intrigue and reversals and defeats and successes and strange twists, and stuff would come out of nowhere. And, you know, the first couple times we got knocked down, we kind of figured it was too easy at first anyway, that, you know, to do something of this magnitude, we probably shouldn't have expected that we'd get it on the first or second try. But when we were at the seventh and the eighth and the ninth incarnation of let's try to do this, it really did take a lot of, as you say, tenacity, I would say determination. There were even points when, you know, people a generation older would call me up or call up others in our group and say things like, this might not be good for your career. You guys ought to think about taking no for an answer and just go find something else. And, of course, we were doing many other things, but if we hadn't stuck with it, none of this would have happened. And that persistence paid off. So the book is really, you know, it's a very human adventure story about really just about a bunch of young scientists that start with a dream and that have to really pay for it. But we got to live our dream, and now we're trying to pay it forward.
And one of the things that struck me as the mission unfolded over the years was a lot of us always associate planetary exploration with one place at NASA. And I think you know what I'm talking about. It's in Southern California. And yet this took place not at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but at the Applied Physics Laboratory at Johns Hopkins. And you had a decision to make there between, was it Charles Alachi at JPL and Tom Kremigis at APL in Maryland? And I just wondered if you could take us through, you know, how you went about that, because that must have had to have been a difficult decision.
It was a difficult decision, and it had to be made quickly, and it had to be, the stakes were very high. Here's the background. The book tells this story in more detail, but NASA had decided to make one last attempt to have a Pluto mission after all these many twists and turns, and very suddenly announced, almost out of the blue, that they would simply, instead of just giving it to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which was the premier institution for planetary mission development in NASA, that they would instead compete the mission, that any group could form a team, and NASA would let them all write proposals, and then it would select the best. And this came out of nowhere. And the day that NASA announced that, my phone started ringing, and the head of the Jet Propulsion Lab wanted me to lead a proposal for them, which I was very flattered about. And then I got another call from their chief rival, the Applied Physics Lab in Maryland, and their head wanted me to lead a proposal. And The conundrum was that although JPL was the Goliath in terms of experience, they had not done well at Pluto mission studies. They had been part of the reason that we had never gotten a spacecraft built. They had mismanaged some of that, but they really wanted me to lead it, and the other guys wanted me to lead it, and I decided to ask both laboratory directors two questions and see what their answers were. And I won't spoil the story completely, but basically when I asked those questions, the guy at APL gave me the right answers, and the guy at JPL gave me pretty disappointing answers. And even though APL was less experienced and a riskier bet, when I slept on it, I decided that I should go with APL. And in the end, that worked out. Because they really stuck with it and not only made it a winning proposal, but made the whole project possible.
And at APL, that was Tom, correct?
That was Tom Kremigis, absolutely.
Kremigis. He's a pretty amazing guy. Could you just give us a quick nutshell description of what he's like?
Well, Tom is an amazing guy. He's a legend in the field of space science. He was born in Greece. And raised in Greece until he was a teenager when he came to the United States, and then went to university here. And he actually studied under one of the gods of our field, if you will, James Van Allen, after whom the Van Allen radiation belts are named, and took his PhD with Van Allen right around 1960. and then went to work very early in his career at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, and became a legendary space scientist and then program executive, and ended up running their entire space division, and has been involved in missions to every single planet, all the way from Mercury out to Pluto, and is now a giant back in Greece and a giant here in the United States. He has been a mentor to me for many years, and it's really paid off.
Yeah, he certainly was a great champion for you and supporter that helped make this all happen.
Well, he did, and even when the chips were down, he never once wavered. He had made me a promise that if we won it, he would never let it go, and he would fight for whatever it took. And even when there were some pretty significant threats, as the book describes, he showed that he's got a spine of steel, and that was a very important thing, because we came to a turning point where, had he wavered, none of this would have ever happened.
Yes, he's one of many, many heroic figures in this story. I'd like to ask you about something that made me laugh a couple of times, because it also made me think about the way I view the world. And this was kind of a minor part of the story, but it happened at some critical times. And that's kind of the role of superstition. You know, for science types like you and I, you know, you're not supposed to be that way. One of the things that happened is you had to fuel the plutonium for the energy source onto the spacecraft on one of those days that people associate with bad luck, right?
Right, right.
Friday the 13th.
Yep. Right before we were ready to launch, the NASA guy in charge of the launch campaign came to me and he said very respectfully, he said, "Dr. Stern, I just realized that the day that the spacecraft will become alive, the day that we fuel the nuclear power generator, is a Friday the 13th. And he said, "I know that some people are superstitious about that kind of thing." And he said, "You know, if that doesn't sit well with you, I'm ready to pay the overtime for people to work on Saturday the 14th and do that work instead. Because I don't want you worrying at the launch and during the countdown, and I don't want you worried in flight that we jinxed it." And he said, "What do you want to do? Just tell me, you know, if you want the overtime paid for." And I thought about it for a little bit and thought about how, that's a silly thing about Friday the 13th. And, you know, I know that Apollo 13 had its problem on a Friday the 13th. But, you know, that's just random. So I told him, I said, "Let's fuel it. Let's not worry about all that superstitious stuff." And we did. And then I decided that we would make Friday the 13th our lucky day on the New Horizons project, and we have often celebrated them ever since as the kind of anniversary of when our spacecraft was born.
That's cool. But then there's another part of the story where things get flipped a little bit on you, and that is the loss of contact with New Horizons that happens just days before the close encounter. And as I recall, they're going to upload these commands to the spacecraft and all the stuff that it has to do, the critical elements, the software during the flyby. And you always want to be there for everything, being the principal investigator, and you go and watch. And then you get an email later on afterwards. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I was alone in mission control with the flight controllers at, I don't know, it was 3 or 4 in the morning, on the morning of July the 4th, 2015, while this long command load, this basically computer program that we had worked on for years and years, which was all the instructions for the flyby for the spacecraft, was being sent by radio command up all the way across the solar system to the spacecraft. And and I sat there and watched it go up and chit-chatted a little bit with the flight controllers while they were doing it, and then left and went off to my office a little later that morning, maybe 6 a.m. or something, after they finished. When I got to my office, I opened an email from Alice Bowman, who's in charge of all of our mission operations. And she said, I had a premonition overnight, and I don't think you should have gone to the control. I don't think you should go to the control center. But by then, you know, I was opening up an email that was hours old, and I'd already been, and I kind of sloughed it off. But then 9 hours later, when we found out that that command load had gone haywire on the spacecraft, because we lost contact with it during the time it was being uploaded, I did think to myself, boy, I wonder if Alice's premonition was right. And even though I'm not superstitious, you know, I couldn't help but think that. And I remember during the very complicated days that followed when we were trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again and be ready for that flyby that was just days away, I went to Alice at one point when things were looking up, and I said to her, I said, I said, I'm so sorry. I sat in mission control when you didn't feel good about it. I wish I'd known, but it's too late now. And hope you don't feel bad about it. And we both had a laugh.
Well, it was no laughing matter until you did get the spacecraft back. And of course you do, and you get to fly by and everything. I would like to know, we're running a bit out of time here, but I'd like to know, what was it like for you, or when was the moment when you knew this has all worked and beyond my wildest expectations, how great this is all? What was it like for that moment after all these years of tribulations to get that moment of this is just fantastic and it's all worked?
Well, you know, for me, there were two events just hours apart on the 14th of July. The first was in the morning, very early, 5 a.m., the science team was assembled for work, and the very first high-resolution image that had been taken the day before flyby, but it showed canyons and glaciers and mountain ranges and all this detail, what a spectacular planet Pluto is, and just seeing that image and seeing the emotion in the room from, you know, the team that had worked on this for 15 years, and it was a one-shot deal. It was either going to work or it wasn't. And to see how gratified this team was that it worked in anonymity all this time and it achieved this monumental exploration, the farthest exploration of any worlds in the history of humankind. That was the first big moment for me. And the second was when the spacecraft made radio contact that night and basically said, I finished the main part of the flyby and everything's gone well. Those served as bookends on an amazing day. And for me, as rewarding as seeing the data start to come to the ground and what Pluto and its system of moons look like, to see our team that had worked so hard and had been the underdogs in so many ways, but we had achieved this amazing success, to see those people and how gratified they were and how proud they were of their work and the fact that so many people across the world, you know, were sending messages and watching on the web and so forth. It was, for me, watching the team celebrate this success was at least as good as the images of Pluto.
Well, finally, one of the moments I found really touching, and I understood it on a deep level, because I have spoken with Apollo astronauts, is Amy Scheer Teitel was one of your media people working with you there, and she walked with you, I believe, and asked you a question about, you know, when this is all over and the flyby is a success, when it's all over, how do you handle that? And I'm just curious, is like, what is it like now that you're post flyby and dealing with the aftermath? Is there things that you've learned about yourself that have made this worthwhile?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. You know, as we were getting close to the Pluto flyby after flying 9 years, and now we only had a matter of months and then weeks and then days left, a number of people said out loud something that I'd been thinking, which is, gosh, I've had this in my future for so long. I've looked forward to it for such a long time. I kind of want to put the brakes on. I want to savor this, but it feels like we're just barreling towards it. And then Amy asked me that question. You know, she said, more or less, She said, "Are you going to have a nervous breakdown after this flyby? What were you going to do with yourself?" You know, and but it turned out that the public interest and the data more than filled the hole left by not having this in your future, having it in the rearview mirror, because those were replaced with even better things. And so it really was a very easy transition. And I think that's true for everybody on the project, in part just because Pluto turned out to be so spectacular scientifically and so beautiful as a place, such a place that reminded us in many ways of Earth, even though so far away, that really that kind of became a non-event. We went on into this other era of our lives and our careers in which now we know Pluto, and now we know how fascinating that part of the solar system is. And we also know that we really did it. After we worked on it all those years, we really did succeed at it. And that is a tremendous feeling for all of us who worked on the project.
And now you get to share that story of everything that came before with all of us again through this book.
Well, that's right. And I hope people get a chance to read it, because it's an amazing story, kind of an underdog story, an underdog planet, and an underdog team that both ended up wowing the world. It took a long time to do it, and it took a lot of creativity and ingenuity and determination. But in the end, it was completely successful, and something I think that changed the world a little bit for the better.
And New Horizons isn't finished yet, is it?
No, the spacecraft's healthy and has plenty of power and fuel. We can run it for another 20 years. In fact, we have another flyby, not of Pluto, but a little building block of planets like Pluto, a billion miles further out, and that will be on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day this coming year. So we're really looking forward to that. We're in the throes of all the detailed planning for that flyby. And come December and January, we're going exploring again.
Well, when that happens, you can pop a cork of metaphorical champagne for me.
Thanks so much, David.
Well, I appreciate having you on. Alan Stern, co-author of Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. Alan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to our guests, Alan Stern and David Grinspoon, co-authors of Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful Northern California. Check out this and past episodes on mynspr.org and subscribe to your mobile device. Blue Dot on NPR Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that when viewed from Pluto, we all live on a pale blue dot.